This is Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Presented by Fasig Tipton.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Top Fletcher.
The result will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Mike Penna.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the show Trainers Listen To, Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, with you once again for the next hour all across North America on Sirius 219, XM 201, and streaming live or podcast on our HRRN website at horseracingradio.net. In 2014, a horse with an obscure pedigree by the name of California Chrome took trainer Art Sherman and his sons on the ride of a lifetime. Still the fourth richest horse in North American racing history, the son of Lucky Pulpit carried his flashy chestnut frame and signature white markings to victory in the Kentucky Derby and Preakness as a three-year-old, but he was just getting started at that point. After an abbreviated four-year-old campaign, California Chrome returned with a vengeance in his five-year-old season, capturing the Dubai World Cup, Pacific Classic, and Awesome Again stakes prior to a narrow defeat in the Breeders' Cup Classic. Art Sherman's son, Alan, was by not only his dad's side for that remarkable journey, but he never left the horse's side either. A horse of a lifetime. Alan is now training on his own under the name of Alan Sherman Racing Stable, and he's hoping to one day find a horse half as brilliant as California Chrome. They're not easy to come by. Alan is with me now on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Alan, welcome, my friend.
Thank you, Mike. Pleasure.
You think you'll ever find another one like Chrome?
Oh, I don't know. That's kind of a once-in-a-lifetime horse, but I sure would. I'm going to keep trying, that's for sure.
When you get a horse like that, and you have that kind of success, and you go on that kind of a ride, does it make you want to get there, you know, all the more? I mean, you've experienced it. You've tasted it. Do you want to get there even more?
Oh, absolutely. You know, once you get a taste of running in those kind of races and being around that type of horse, you just want to keep going. You know, I can imagine how a lot of these trainers, you know, when they get to go to the big races every year. That's got to be such a thrill for them. I mean, for me to do it once was just amazing. And, you know, you get that taste for it and the experience and things you might do different, things you do the same. But, yeah, I'd love to do that again.
I remember when you were going through that run and we had many conversations, one of the things that came up quite often and quite often in interviews on the show was your puppy at the time, Jasper. He's now a full-grown dog, and I could hear him in the background. You sent him to obedience lessons while you were going through that Triple Crown back in 2014. Doesn't really sound like they worked, man. You might want to get your money back.
Well, we've got some thunder and lightning rolling through right now, so he got him fired up. But, yeah, he is a bit hard-headed, but he's a good boy.
Yeah, he's learned really well, and he's come along very nicely, and you're kind of a team now. You were a team with California Chrome, now you're a team with Jasper. What kind of dog is he?
He's a yellow lab.
Yeah, what was harder, training California Chrome or teaching Jasper in the early days?
Oh, Jasper for sure. Chrome
really?
Chrome was pretty easy, yeah. Chrome did everything we asked of him. Jasper, he kind of rebels a little bit sometimes.
Well, that's all right. That's what puppies are supposed to do. When you hear the name California Chrome now, what, 7 years later, what things immediately pop into your head?
Oh, the first thing is the Kentucky Derby. I mean, I just remember that like it was yesterday. It was so much fun and just, we made the most out of it too, you know, We enjoyed ourselves very much and tried to have as much fun as possible, even with all the pressure and everything. But not just to win the race, but just to have a horse good enough to run in it was a thrill. But then to win it was just amazing. It was hair still stands up on my arms when I think about it.
It's interesting that you mentioned the word pressure, because many times I'll have trainers on this show, Alan, and they'll tell you, well, yeah, there's pressure, but not when you have a horse that's this talented. That takes some of the pressure off because the horse does the talking for you. But there was some pressure going into the Kentucky Derby, huh?
Oh, absolutely. You know, he was the favorite, you know, coming off some really big wins in the Santa Anita Derby, and he won that race pretty easy. And, you know, like I said, he was the favorite going in, and all the cameras on you, and, you know, and you always worry about traffic problems in that race with there being such a large field. And I thought going in the race, he was the best three-year-old. If he got a decent trip, I thought he would be very tough to beat. And Victor rode him superbly, and he got a perfect trip. And he won by 3 or 4 lengths, and it was just the thrill of a lifetime.
Yeah, and it's so difficult to win that race. Last week on this program, I had a chance to visit with Scott Blasey, the assistant to Hall of Famer Steve Asmussen, who is now the all-time leader in wins in thoroughbred racing in North America, surpassing Dale Baird. And here's Steve Asmussen that's won all those races, Breeders' Cup races, classic races, and he can't break through in the Kentucky Derby. And here's Alan and Art Sherman and the team of California Chrome with a horse like this who has no pedigree to speak of, and he goes on not only to win the Derby, but he goes on to be right now the number 4 all-time career earner in thoroughbred racing. Just remarkable the way this game works.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we got lucky for sure. I mean, you always got to have luck in this game, but you also have to have the right horse. I think the majority of the time you need a horse that's got a good turn of foot, you know, to keep himself out of trouble. That's very important. And, you look back and you see all the people that have tried to win it. I mean, Sheikh Mohammed and all these huge owners, you know, trying to buy horses just to run in the Kentucky Derby and hope to win it. And for us to run in it once and win it is, you don't see that very often, that's for sure.
And I keep talking about that pedigree because that was the storyline going into the Kentucky Derby that year. It wasn't the flashiest pedigree in the world, and a lot of people doubted that he'd ever be able to get the mile and a quarter distance, and he proved everybody wrong. When you start looking now, Alan, now that you've started your own operation and you start looking at young horses, do you find yourself maybe getting away from pedigree a little bit and looking for the athlete and the confirmation that a horse possesses, considering the fact that you had so much success with a horse like California Chrome that didn't have a strong pedigree?
Oh, absolutely. You know, especially with the type of horses I can afford to buy, I have to give up something, whether it's pedigree or confirmation. And 10 out of 10 times I'm giving up pedigree for confirmation and looking for the athlete. You know, it would be nice to be able to go to the sales with the millions and dollars and say, I want this one, and this one that are all perfect, but that's just simply not the case. But, like I said, we're more after the athlete than the pedigree.
What does a horse that's a good athlete as a yearling, as a two-year-old in training, let's say, what does a horse like that possess physically that lets you know that they are a good athlete?
Well, I like to look at a good strong hind leg, a good gasket, nice hip, good shoulder. Those are the three main things I look at. You know, you look, and then you go down to their front legs, and you don't want a horse that's terribly offset in the knees and stuff. But if he, you know, toes out a little bit or toes in or a little bit offset in the knees, And, you know, I look at the x-rays. If I feel like it's something I can deal with, then that's great. I'll take a shot on that one.
We hear that a lot in, you know, I know when I was covering horse sales, we were broadcasting them on the network here. We would visit with people that would talk about the repositories and the vet reports and how you have to kind of take them with a grain of salt if you really like the horse. You almost, unless it's something egregious, you almost have to look past that and just look at the horse himself and hope that you're right and he gets past all of those little things that might be nagging him early on. Is that a good way to look at it?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think a lot of people are too dependent on the vet these days. I mean, you look at all the horses that haven't passed the vet and have went on to be great horses. I definitely think that people depend on the vet too much. I mean, it's one thing when you scope a horse and he's got a small airway or he can't breathe well. Well, then that's a definite, you know, scratch. You don't want that one. He's not getting enough air. But if he's got, you know, a spur in the hock or a spur in the knee or something like that, those are the kind of things I could deal with. I'm not looking for OCDs in the stifles. I don't like that. But, you know, there's minor things that some people might not like because they're not perfect, which I feel I can deal with.
If somebody's listening right now, Alan, and they hear you say OCDs in the stifle, that's a term that's thrown around in the industry. Explain to people what that is.
That is a lesion in their stifles that it's not going to – you can operate on it, but it will always be a weak spot there in the bone. Personally, my experience with those have not been good. It's always a weak spot there, and I just try to stay away from them if I can.
You have moved to Lexington, Kentucky from California now. You did that a couple of years ago. You're getting settled in here. I mentioned the fact that you've now started Alan Sherman Racing Stables. It's something you've wanted to do for a long time, to go out and train on your own. But in the meantime, you've also spent time with your friends over at TaylorMade Farm, and you've worked the sales for them. So you've seen the other side of it, and you've looked at an awful lot of yearlings and weanlings over the years. How has that improved your eye for a horse?
Oh, it's helped me immensely. You know, I feel like I've always had a decent eye for a horse, but after working for them for the past 2 years, you really start to learn from them. And, you know, Frank Taylor, who's a good friend of mine, he's helped me out, and Duncan and Mark. And, you know, they're all very nice people that anytime I have a question, they're right there to answer it or, you know, help me in any way I need. But, you know, you look at those thousands of horses you looked at and, you know, it's you got no choice but just to get better at it, you know. And then you go on to kind of keep track of some of them, and some of them turn out to be great horses, and you're like, oh, I love that horse as a yearling. I wish I could have bought him. But, you know, I've learned so much the past couple of years working for them.
That's such an interesting dynamic because, you know, a horse is a horse, right? And once you get good at looking them, you said you had a good eye for a horse before. How do you improve your eye? What things did you learn that help you even more now?
Oh, they just taught me a few different things, like how the neck ties into a horse, what they like and what they don't like, their hind ends, different things on their hind ends they like and what they don't like. And then you look at the good horses that are running, and you can see, well, yeah, that horse's neck ties in just perfect, or that horse's hind end is, you know, look how strong it is. So, you know, there's something to be said about all that. Obviously, there's horses that come in all shapes and sizes that can really run, but, you know, if you can try and get the total package, then it seems to help your chances.
Talking with Alan Sherman here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. He and his dad, Art, and his brother went down the road and had that remarkable journey with California Chrome back in 2014 and 2015 and 16. And we'll talk more about some of his favorite California Chrome memories as we move throughout the program here. But, Alan, I'm curious, knowing what you now know and with that improved eye for picking out young horses, which is going to help you with your new racing stable, by the way, if you were to go to a sale and California Chrome was a yearling in that sale and you were inspecting him, do you think you would have given him a high grade and maybe purchased him from that sale?
California Chrome had a great hip and a great shoulder, but if you look at him, he's pretty offset in his knees. I wouldn't have given him a high grade, but I wouldn't have dismissed him at all.
Huh, that's interesting. So maybe you wouldn't even have ended up with California Chrome if it was left up to you.
Well, I don't know. It depends how much he costs.
What do you hope to accomplish with the new racing stable? Obviously win lots of races, but where do you see it going?
Well, we're starting to pick up. You know, I've got new client named Matt Montgomery that I'm training a couple horses for, who's got a farm here in Lexington. And I trained for George Krikorian, who we've trained for many years, and he sent me a few. So, it's starting to pick up, and, trying to get some better quality horses. That's always the goal. But, right now we're just kind of we're taking what we can and building up. And the horses I've got in training are doing well. I'm happy with them. And we're up there at Turfway Park because the barn we were in at the Thoroughbred Center, they tore it down and they're rebuilding some barns there. So it'll be nice to get back into some new barns when we get there. We were going to go to Churchill, but obviously they closed down because of the group. They're rebuilding the turf course. And we were in Lexington at Keeneland, and we had to get out of there because they're getting ready for their September sale. So we didn't have much choice but to go up to Turfway.
Turfway has a synthetic racing surface. What's it like training over that surface?
The synthetic tracks are great in the wintertime. Personally, I'd rather not be on them in the summertime, but that being said, this one has been really good. It seems, it's a newer surface. It's not broke down yet, so it's still got plenty of bounce and horses seem to handle it well. So far I'm happy with it.
Do you have to adjust your approach when you're training the horses over synthetic as opposed to training them over a conventional dirt surface?
Yeah, there's a few things that I like to do different. I like to pull their hind shoes because a horse's foot is made to slide a little bit when it hits the ground. But on those synthetic surfaces, they seem not to slide and kind of they could get jarred up behind if you train them with shoes on. So I tend to take the hind shoes off of all of mine, but I will put them back on like race day and run them with hind shoes no matter, wherever they're running, Indiana or Belterra or wherever they're going to run, I'll put hind shoes on and back on them.
Yeah, it's interesting. I guess the convenient thing about being at Turfway, I guess it would be the same if you were at Churchill or in Lexington, is that you're central to a lot of racetracks that are offering pretty good money right now, so it's an easy ship for you.
Yeah, absolutely. That's one good thing about being here. You're not on an island like you are in California. California, you're either running in California or, I guess you could go to Phoenix. But other than that, there's really nowhere else to go. You're kind of stuck there.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the one thing we always hear about California racing. And as somebody who spent so much time out there, talk a little bit about that. Talk about those challenges that are different on the West Coast than what you're facing here.
Oh, absolutely. On the West Coast, it's getting harder and harder to train your horse. You have to go through all the vets, have to sign off on workers, which is fine. I mean, I'm not going to work a horse that's not sound anyways, but just it feels like they're looking over your shoulder constantly, and it's just hard to train a horse more so now than it was in the past.
Yeah, and a lot of people will say it's hard to train a horse anywhere now with the situation that the sport is in and, all of the different protocols that are in place. But the one thing that has always come up, Alan, I'm curious to get your thoughts on this, is the fact that we don't have a uniform program across the board in our sport where the rules, say the medication and withdrawal times, are the same in Kentucky or in Florida or in California and New York, and they're the same across the board. We don't have that. It's different from state to state. The rules are different. The regulations are different. How challenging is that for a horse trainer?
It is challenging. Like, I ran a horse in Indiana last week, and I'm running one in Ohio this week, and the rules are different. I believe that they should be the same all the way in across America. Make it the same rules. I'm definitely an advocate for Lasix. I don't think that should be banned at all. I think it's a preventative. It's not an enhancer. I think that you're going to find horses that are going to be needed to be turned out more, and you're going to get smaller fields, and it's going to shorten horses' careers by not having Lasix. I can see, okay, you don't want to run the two-year-olds on Lasix. That's fine. But, you know, to penalize horses and the good horses, you're penalizing them by not letting them run on Lasix. They get to these kind of races running on Lasix, and then all of a sudden they prove themselves to be able to run in these big races, and you can't run on Lasix when they've been running on Lasix the whole time. Like I said, it's not a performance enhancer. It's just a preventative. I took Lasix when I was riding to lose weight, and it makes you feel crappy. You know, it doesn't make you feel good. And I can imagine the horses, they get drawn up. I mean, they'll lose, you know, 25 pounds, you know, with the Lasix, between the Lasix and running, they'll lose 20-25 pounds, you know. But that being said, it's keeping them, their capillaries in their lungs, you know, from swelling up and bleeding. You know, that it shrinks those capillaries down to where they're not going to bleed. So I think that Lasix is a great drug, and I don't think they should do away with it, but that it looks like that's the way it's going, so we're just going to all have to deal with it.
Yeah, it's an interesting debate, and there are people, and it has been a hot-button debate in the sport for many years. There's people who are vehemently opposed to it. There are people like yourself and a lot of horsemen who say, no, it's a good preventative drug. It's a therapeutic medication. It helps the horse. What is the purpose of giving a horse Lasix in the first place?
Well, I don't give horses Lasix unless they've proved to me that they've bled. You know, I scope most of my horses after they work. And if they bleed a little bit, then I put them on Lasix. If they never bleed, then they never go on Lasix.
So is that the only medication that should be allowed?
To run race day, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Horses will train on other medications, much like a regular professional athlete would do in other sports. They'll use other products during their training, but just not on race day. Am I right on that?
Correct, yeah. I mean, there are therapeutic drugs out there that help get through the everyday training. It's like you said, they're athletes, just like any other athlete. They might wake up one day with, you know, be a little stiff or be a little sore, and you know, there's medications you can give them for that just to help them. They're not going out and running on that day. I think it's fine. Just, you know, help them out a little bit. Just like, I mean, you know, humans get, you take aspirin if you're sore or got a headache or whatever. Take a few aspirin, makes you feel better.
Yeah. We've talked about athletes who will use an inhaler, for example. Or who will take Advil or an anti-inflammatory, whatever it might be, before or after their workouts or during their workouts. There are certain medications that are allowed like that that are therapeutic, and I think that's the argument from the side that says, yeah, we should be keeping Lasix and we shouldn't change that. Talking with Alan Sherman, who is now out on his own, Alan Sherman Racing is the name of his racing stable. How many horses do you have right now, Alan?
I've got about a half a dozen right now, and I've got a couple more in Del Mar that are going to be heading this way when that meet is done. So hopefully, we'll get it up 10, 12 here pretty soon.
You got a pretty good filly coming from Del Mar, don't you?
I do. I got a filly I own a piece of named Acting Out. Last time she ran, she broke through the gate and banged her head on the gate and kind of scratched her head all up and banged her head. They probably should have scratched her, but they didn't. They let her run, and she showed speed and stopped. It was unfortunate that that happened. She did that. The horse on the inside of her broke through the gate, and she thought it was time to go. So she, broke through the gate herself and ended up banging her head a little bit and had some scratches and little blood. She had a fat lip, but, I wish they would have scratched her, but they didn't. So it is what it is. But she's going to get a little freshening up, and then when she gets here, I'm going to turn her out for a few weeks, let her be a horse, and then get her back going again.
How does a trainer deal with those situations mentally? Because you can do everything right with a horse. You can take your time. You can get them ready. You can feel like they're sitting on a big effort. And then something like that happens that's totally out of your control. How do you handle that mentally?
It's a little frustrating, but, there's a lot of things that go on in this business that are frustrating. They're not machines. They are living, breathing animals, and stuff happens, and if you let it get to you, it'll drive you crazy. You just gotta move on, and you get aggravated for a few minutes, but then it's like, well, as long as she's gonna be okay, we'll live to fight another day.
Yeah, things happen in this sport, and nobody knows that as well as Alan Sherman. He has been competing at every level of this game, from a jockey to training horses at, smaller racetracks, and training horses on the big stage, like the Kentucky Derby and the Breeders' Cup, as we talked about with California Chrome. And we're going to spend more time talking about Chrome and his career. We'll spend more time talking about some of the other horses that Alan has been around and some of the things he learned in working with his dad that are going to help him now. We'll do all of that in the second half of the program when I return. This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Nominations are still open for the Fasig Tipton November Sale, the world's premier breeding stock event. Last year, the sale produced the 8 highest-priced fillies and mares sold at any U.S. breeding stock sale, led by Monomoy Girl, selling for $9.5 million. 22 horses sold for $1 million or higher, and the sale also produced the co-highest-priced weanling sold in the U.S. last year. Nominate your best today to the Fasig Tipton November Sale, a night of stars, Tuesday, November 9th in Lexington, Kentucky. Where will you sell? Consistent success tested over time. There is no better example than Millridge Farm. Founded in 1962 by Alice Chandler, this year's inductee into the Hall of Fame as Pillar of the Turf. Since 2000, Millridge has raised or sold 36 Grade 1 winners, including 8 Breeders' Cup winners and 2 Horses of the Year. Millridge offers its largest and highest quality consignment ever at this year's Fasig Tipton Saratoga Sale, with 9 yearlings by leading stallions and promising first-year sires, and will be showing at Barn 5 on Friday, August 6th. Millridge, standing the test of time. The richest meet in Oak Lawn's history begins Friday, December 3rd through Sunday, May 8th. The 66-day meet will offer more than $45 million in purses, with 36 stakes races totaling $12.3 million. And all allowance races are now worth $100,000. Oak Lawn boasts the richest Triple Crown prep series in the country, highlighted by the $1 million Rebel on Friday, February 26th, and the Grade 1 Arkansas Derby Saturday, April 2nd, now offering a purse of $1.25 million. Learn more at oaklawn.com.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
And California Chrome makes his move for the lead. It is California Chrome on the outside. Samrat runs at him with the gate pole. California Chrome is pulling away. California Chrome into the final furlong. He's got a 5-length lead on his competition. It is California Chrome in front. And from the back of the
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. That call by Larry Colmus never gets old for the Shermans and for the connections of California Chrome, the fourth all-time money earner in thoroughbred racing currently, still in 2021. He has held that mark for a very long time, and simply sensational. What a day that was. He would go on and win the Preakness afterwards before coming up short in his bid for the Triple Crown. No shame there, because then he had a weird four-year-old campaign, came back as a five-year-old, and just dominated thoroughbred racing. And, boy, it has been a fun ride for Alan Sherman, who is my special guest here on Trainer Talk. I'm going to continue this visit right after I remind you that if you did miss any portion of this show or any of our Trainer Talk shows, head back to our website, horseracingradio.net, and check out the podcast at your leisure. You can also listen Horse Racing Radio Network on Apple Podcasts and wherever you access those podcasts that you like to listen to. So we hope you binge listen to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton each and every week. Alan, that call has to bring back some amazing memories. You said that was one of yours, if not the top California Chrome memory, so I figured we'd bring it back to you one more time.
Oh, yeah, that never gets old. You know, even now, I'll go back and watch it on YouTube once in a while. It gives you a good feeling, you know. He's such a special horse, and he was so good to us and so fun to be around. And it was just a great, great experience for my family and for the horse, too, I think. I think he enjoyed every moment of it. He loved to pose for the cameras, and, you know, he was kind of a ham himself. He knew when the cameras were clicking, he'd prick his ears and look around, and he enjoyed it just as much as we did, I think.
He brought a very exciting and somewhat controversial ownership group together, and we recently lost one of the owners of California Chrome, Denise Martin, who passed away at the age of 61. That was back in June 14th, as a matter of fact. Tell me a little bit more about Denise and about the partnership that was involved with California Chrome.
Oh, Denise was a special lady. She was such a sweetheart, you know. She was kind of soft-spoken and never had a bad thing to say about anybody. She was she'd love that horse, it was a shame that we lost her at such a young age. She'll be missed dearly for sure.
The other partners, there were times when they were in the spotlight and people were scratching their heads going, what on earth is going on? What was it like for you as the trainer trying to keep the horse on track and at times dealing with some distractions there?
Well, I tried not to let that distract me too much, to be honest. I just, I listened to what he said, and I just, you know, I that was it. Just, I worried about the horse. I can't make him say or not say anything. He had his own voice, and obviously, he might have had a cocktail or two before then. you know, it is what it is. There's nothing I could do about it, so I couldn't dwell on it. As long as the horse is okay, that was my main concern.
Yeah, of course, talking about Steve Coburn, one of the owners involved with Perry Martin and his wife with California Chrome in that run in 2014. Alan, we talked about what you are doing now with your new Alan Sherman Racing Stable here in Kentucky. Tell me about what your dad, Art, is up to.
Oh, he's still going strong. He's got, I believe he's got 10 head down there at Del Mar. He keeps threatening to retire, but we'll see. He says this is his last year. But my mom's kind of bending his ear a little bit, hoping he retires this year. But you know, he's been doing it his whole life, basically from the time he was 16 till now, and he's 83. So he doesn't have any hobbies. You know, he doesn't fish. He doesn't golf. His hobby is basically going to the track in the morning and BSing with all his friends and people out at the track. That's what he loves to do. It would be nice if he if if he does retire, it'd be nice if he could just kind of stay in it at some capacity, you know, I don't know, maybe be a stable agent or whatever, you know, if he's long, he just wants to be there. You know, he doesn't want to sit at home and do nothing. I think that would probably, you know, that would be worse on his health than getting up every morning and working. He's in great health now, thank God. And, there comes a time in everybody's life that, you kind of think about retiring. But I think he would train then forever if he could, or he can, who knows? He might not retire this year. We'll see. It's yet to be seen.
Why don't you bring him and Mom to Kentucky? He can work as your assistant.
You know, I tried to get him to come out here. My mom would love to. You know, she's from Tennessee. She was born and raised in Tennessee, and she's still got her sisters there. And she's actually coming out here in October for a couple weeks, going down to Tennessee to see her sisters and stuff. But she would love to do it. My dad doesn't want to do it because of the weather.
Yeah, I can't blame him. He's a California guy through and through, right?
Yeah, well, he was born in Brooklyn, but he moved out of there when he was 7, so
early.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, yeah, he's used to those Southern California non-winters, if you will, or a warm winter in Southern California.
Exactly.
It would be a little different coming here. I could certainly relate to that. But, boy, glad to see Art Sherman still doing his thing and doing well out on the West Coast. Your brother Steve is having one heck of a year, too.
Oh, he's on fire right now. He's doing very well. I think he's leading trainer at Golden Gate right now. He won a nice stake at Del Mar this summer. He's having a good go of it right now.
If you were to take a graphic, and we can't do that here on radio, obviously, because we don't have pictures, but if we put up a graphic, and we'll ask people to visualize this, and it had your picture, your dad's picture, and your brother Steve's picture side by side, and it listed a couple of bullet points about each of your philosophies on training racehorses. What do you think each one of those graphics would say? Starting with yours.
Well, it's funny. We all have similar training regimens we do with the horses. You know, we train very similar. My brother, I would say, he is the most aggressive as far as placing his horses. He's a really good handicapper, and he runs his horses where they can win. He hates to lose. None of us like losing, but he tends to take it to heart a little bit more than me and my dad do.
Okay.
My dad is old school. You know, he learned under Rex Ellsworth, and his mentor was Paul Godotti, who was an old-time trainer in Northern California. He rode for him and worked for him before he went out on his own. And he's old school, you know. Doesn't want to do a lot of vet work. Doesn't like the fact that he's got to ask the vet if it's okay to work his horses. He's old school, and he does it the old school way. He takes very good care of his horses. You know, all three of us feed our horses very well. They're all taken care of very well. That's the number one priority for, you know, all three of us is the horse comes first. You know, we might miss a meal, but those horses are going to eat very well.
Yeah.
I kind of feel like I'm in between the two of them. I like to be aggressive when I enter. I think if I have a horse in a race that's over 10 or 12 to 1, I feel like I probably entered in the wrong spot. I take the old school approach to some training, certain horses. And other horses, I don't train them near as hard as some of the old school guys do. If you got lighter horses or... You know, you got to train them as individuals. A heavier horse might need a little more training than a little, like, filly. You know, you just got to kind of – you got to just play it by ear as the horse goes. But, you know, growing up watching a lot of these guys train, the old school guys, their horses were in a regiment. They every horse did the same thing, you know, that had the same schedule, and which worked great for him back then. But, you know, I think horses were stronger back then than they are now as far as their bone goes. I think they had better bone back then. They tended to last a little bit longer and race more without having the issues we have now as far as keeping the horses sound. So I kind of just try and play it by ear and let the horse tell me what they want to do.
If you were to try to put your finger on the one attribute that you absolutely have to have if you're going to be a horse trainer and be successful as a horse trainer, what would you say that one attribute would be?
Patience. Gotta have patience. You can't rush these horses. You know, if you start pushing them, they're gonna fall apart on you. You know, like Whittingham said, they're like strawberries. They could spoil overnight. You can't push them. You got to let them tell you when they're ready to pick up their training, or when they're ready to work or ready to run. You can't look at the condition book and see a race a month out and say, oh, that's where we're running no matter what. You know, you can try and train them up to that race, and hopefully by the time you enter, they're, you know, right where you want them. But sometimes that's not the case, and you just, if the owners allow it, just, you know, say, hey, we're not going to run in this race. He's just not ready yet. And that could be the opposite, too. You know, they horses could be training out of their mind, and then all of a sudden, you know, you're like, oh, I need to find a race for this horse, and there happens to be a race next week, and you go ahead and run the horse.
Yeah. Can you think of a horse off the top of your head that really put your patience to the test?
There's been a few. let's see. I'm just trying to think of one in particular. Well, a horse like Siren Lure, we claimed him for $50,000. He ended up being our first grade one winner. He had some issues with, you know, he had a one knee that would bother him some. And if you pushed him too much, you know, he would say, hey, slow down a little bit. You know, he would get a little bit sore on you. But as long as we took our time with him and spread his races out right, he definitely would run his best race. And Tony Malconian, the owner of that horse, he was the best owner. He would let us do our thing, you know, never pushed us to run him or anything like that. He just said, well, we'll just run him when he's right. And ended up working up out in the long run. He made just shy of $1 million. He won the Triple Bend, which is a grade one. He won on turf. He ran on dirt. He was a nice horse. We ran him in the Breeders' Cup that year. I think it was 2011, if I'm not mistaken, and Churchill, and the track come up really sloppy, and that was the year that everything on the rail was winning. Mm-hmm. And he had like the 13 or 14 hole, so that kind of his chances were done then. But he was a super nice horse, and he made you be patient,
you know. And you mentioned the relationship with the owners and having an owner that understands what the trainer is hoping to accomplish and kind of just lets the trainer make the call. It's so important to have that type of relationship. And I know you're working with George Krikorian now. You mentioned his name and some of the other folks that are involved with helping you get your new racing stable off the ground. But how much of an emphasis do you place on that, Alan, when you're trying to get this thing going? Do you want just any owner, or do you want an owner that fits with your approach and your philosophy and you can be in lockstep with them?
Well, you know, you got to work together. That's the main thing. Like, George is a great owner. He's very, very patient, maybe too patient sometimes. You know, you'll want to run a horse and he'll say, nah, let's wait another couple weeks. You know, but he's a great owner to train for. I've trained for just about anybody, but I'm not gonna But you have to work together. You can't tell your trainer, oh, I want to do this, I want to do that. They're not there every day dealing with the horse, you know, and they don't know, you know, the things that I know about the horse. So I tend to get along with all my owners. I take what they say into consideration, and if it works out that way, fine. If it doesn't, then, you know, we can't do it that way.
Yeah, there has to be some give and take there and some common ground and middle ground to meet, to go forward, and Alan Sherman knows that as good as anybody. He was with me here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Alan, if you could take three horses and insert them into your operation right now, three horses that either you worked with your dad or maybe you rode back in the day, but you can only choose three outside of California Chrome. He's off the board. What three horses would you choose to start your stable with?
Well, I'd probably take one of them would be Siren Lure. He was all guts, that horse. He was such a hard trier. The other horse would probably be our first really good horse. His name was Lick-A-Till Hill.
Yep.
He was a good horse, too. He earned just shy of $1 million the hard way. I mean, he was a stakes horse, but, you know, he won a $200,000 race for us at Del Mar. And then the third one would probably be a horse I rode for Charlie Whittingham named Peace. He was a half brother to Judge Angelucci, and he was a runner. Boy, he was probably the best miler I've ever been on, for sure. He ran a mile in 33 and change a couple times for me, and he was just a really good horse.
Do you think that time you spent riding horses helps you in any way now that you're training?
Oh, absolutely. You know, not only you could just see how the rider's reacting to certain horses, and, you know, you could say, oh, this guy gets along with this horse great, or I got to get a different rider on this horse. He's not, they're not on the same level. You know, they're not jiving real well. They're not getting along well. So we need to make a change. You know, my riding career was only 3 years, but I galloped horses for another 20 years after that. So, you know, I've been on a lot of horses, and I think it helps. Absolutely, I think it helps to be able to, just so you can see how the rider's reacting, and, you know, ask the rider what he thought and get his reactions, and maybe help him, give him a pointer or two or something like that. You know, I definitely think it helps.
Are you the type of trainer that likes to give instructions or a lot of instructions to your jockey before the race?
No, I don't give a lot of instructions. I just, we'll talk about how we think the race might come up, but, you know, once the gates open, that can just go completely out the window. I'm not the kind of guy that's going to say, oh, you got to do this, you got to do that. You know, we'll talk, you know, what do you think, you know, how we think the race will set up. If there's a couple speed horses in there, we should be sitting right behind them. Or there's no speed, I think he could be on the lead. But I'm not the kind of person that's going to tell him what to do out there.
How about when you were riding? Did you like getting a lot of instructions before you got a leg up?
No, oh, I never listened to him anyways. Well, the only one I listened to was Charlie Whittingham. He's a genius. And he always said the same thing. Keep him out of trouble. That's all he said.
Really? That's the only thing he would ever tell you?
Pretty much, yeah. He said, just don't get him in trouble. He didn't care if you went wide or whatever. Just keep him out of trouble. Let him run the race.
What made Charlie Whittingham such a good trainer?
Oh, boy. He was very the way he conditioned his horses. I never seen somebody that could get a horse ready off a layoff or ready for a big race like him. When it was time to he wouldn't train him real hard until it was time to tighten the screws, and then he would definitely kick up the training a little bit. He took phenomenal care of his horses. His horses were just, all of them looked great. And he had good assistance by his side all the time, and he had a great crew of grooms and everybody that, and people that worked for Charlie worked there for years. You know, it wasn't you're here for a month or two and then the guy quits or gets fired or whatever it was. He hired good people and they stuck around and worked for him for years.
Interesting comments and interesting take on what made him so good. I was going to ask you what advice you would give to a trainer who's looking to get started in this profession, but let me do it this way. Since you did spend so much time around Charlie Whittingham, if you were to go to Charlie today and say, hey, I'm going out on my own, I'm starting Alan Sherman Racing Stable, what advice do you give me? What do you think Charlie Whittingham would say to you?
Right now, these days?
Yeah.
Get a different profession, probably. Find something else to do. You know, back then they had stall limits, right? Then there was a lot more horses being foaled, but, you know, they had 40,000 horses a year, you know, foaling, and now it's at about 20, so there's half as many horses. And with that being said, they had stall limits back then, so the owners had to spread their horses around to different trainers. And, you know, most people had a decent-sized stable and made a decent living. Well, now there are no stall limits. You know, obviously you got the so-called, what they call super trainers or whatever, the guys with 200-300 horses in training and all the best clients, and it all comes down to getting the good clients. You know, they have all the best horses. If you can get some good clients, then it makes your job that much easier. It's really tough if you got guys that are buying horses for $5,000 and $10,000 rather than $500,000 or $1,000,000. Obviously, those horses are going to be better horses. They might not make $500,000 or $1,000,000, but your chances going in are a little better than buying one for $5,000.
Yeah, it makes sense. It certainly makes sense. Visiting with Alan Sherman here on the Horse Racing Radio Network, Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Inside the final 16th of a mile here, Alan, we're down to the final 4 minutes of the program. I always like to wrap up by asking trainers to tell me something about them that we haven't touched on yet. And I know that you have various hobbies away from racing, including hunting, not just deer hunting, which you do with me at my farm here in Kentucky. We do that quite often, but you like to hunt ducks and everything too. Is it just hunting, or do you have other things you enjoy doing?
Oh, I love to hunt, and I love to fish, and I try and golf as much as I can. Those are the three things I love to do outside of racing. I try and fish. You know, I think I've been fishing twice this week already until this rain came, and kind of I like to go fishing in the creeks and, you know, catching smallmouth and stuff. And then hunting, we got bird hunting. Dove is going to open up September 1st, and then deer season's right there too. So, you know, that's my favorite time of year. You can bird hunt, fish, and deer hunt all the, you know, same time.
Yeah, you know, I love deer hunting with a passion. You know that from spending time with me out in the woods. But I never got into I just don't understand the whole bird hunting thing. And I know it's hugely popular and people love hunting ducks and doves. And my dad used to take me hunting partridge and pheasant when I was a kid. It just never resonated with me.
Yeah, you know, I think it's exciting, especially duck hunting is probably my favorite thing to do. It's like trying to shoot a 60-mile-an-hour football out of the sky, you know, and then because they fly fast. And then you got the dogs, and watching the dogs work is great. Jasper's not the best duck dog, but he is a great pheasant and quail dog. He'll go into anything to get one of those things to fly. Duck hunting, he gets a little impatient just sitting there waiting, and the ducks kind of spot him, you know, moving around, and doesn't help matters much. But he's a great pheasant and a great quail dog.
How's the golf game coming along?
Oh, not too shabby. The other day we went out and played, me and Billy Morey, a friend of mine who trains horses out here, and we shot pretty good. I think he shot a 79, and I shot 84, which wasn't too bad.
Whoa. Now, wait a minute. You invited me to play with you, and you said we're not real good, but we have a lot of fun. That is about 30 strokes better than anything I've ever shot. So I think you just wanted me to show up with my wallet.
Exactly.
He's crafty. He's a great guy. He's Alan Sherman. He is out on his own now. Alan Sherman Racing Stable. If you're looking for somebody to train your horses around here in Kentucky, why not? Give him a call, and he'll take care of you. Alan, listen, it's been a delight to spend some time with you here today on the program, and so glad that you're able to get things rolling in the right direction, and all the best with the new stable.
Thank you, Mike. I appreciate it, and we'll talk soon.
All right, fun visit here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. And, you know, you think about where Alan has been in this sport and the things that he's been able to accomplish with that run with California Chrome. But he mentioned other horses that competed at a very high level, greatest stakes winners that he talked about outside of California Chrome. He knows what it's like to be around a good horse, and I have no doubt in my mind that he's going to be ultra successful with his Alan Sherman Racing Stable. Been a lot of fun here today. If you missed any portion of the show, head over to our website, horseracingradio.net. You can check out this show and all of our Trainer Talk shows whenever you get some time. For my producer, Lee Delapina, in our Lexington studios, for my special guest, Alan Sherman, and for our sponsor, Fasig Tipton, my thanks to them. I'm Mike Penna. We'll talk to you next week on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton.